Hi, I'm Tim Hernandez. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Our guest today is the debut poet and former student of our fabulous writing program right here at the University of Texas in El Paso, Steve Lambert. We'll be talking with him about his stellar debut collection titled Heat Seekers. I had the privilege of reading an advanced copy of the book, actually in manuscript form, and so I wrote a blurb for it, and I'd like to share that with you because I think it describes the book wonderfully. In this bold and brilliant debut collection of poetry, Lambert drags his ambivalent pen across the vast human field of the sacred mundane and the quietly profound. It's just an all-around great collection, and I'm really looking forward to speaking with our former student and out-in-the-world poet, Steve Lambert, about his book. Stick around. Steve Lambert's writing has appeared in various journals, including Into the Void in Ireland, Red Truck Review, The Gambler, Deep South Magazine, The Cortland Review, and many others. His writing has also been nominated for a Pushcart Prize and Best of the Net. He holds an MFA from our prestigious program here at the University of Texas in El Paso, and he works in a library and lives in Northeast Florida with his wife and daughter. Steve Lambert, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Congratulations on your debut book of poetry titled Heat Seekers, and it's out with Cherry Grove Collections. How does it feel to finally have your, is this your first book, right? Is that right?
Yes.
That's right. Okay.
It feels good. It's a little weird after, you know, writing for so many years and not having one to finally have one, but it's weird in a good way.
Yeah, how many years have you been writing?
About 20 years.
Wow, 20 years.
Yeah.
And has it always been poetry, or were you exploring, like, did you write prose at all? Or?
Yeah. So I guess I was about 22 when I started. And I started with stories, but I found I was having a hard time finishing anything.
Yeah.
Really, it's just because I was completely unprepared and had no idea what I was doing. So
right.
I took a break from writing stories for a little while, and for about 3 years, I wrote nothing but poetry.
Wow.
And so I guess having something a little more manageable to work on sort of taught me how to finish something.
Right.
And then after that period, I did go back to writing fiction again, writing both.
Wow.
But I started trying to write fiction again, and I found that 3 year period of just writing nothing but poetry helped me a lot when it came to trying to write a story and actually finish a story. So
right,
I wasn't thinking of it that way at the time, but in retrospect, that's what was happening.
It sort of became the practice grounds for writing and finishing projects, huh?
I think so. Yeah.
And you know, I know Walter Mosley talks about in one of his books. I forgot which one it was. He talks about how poets make the best prose writers. And so as prose writers, we should always study poetry anyway, you know, and I tend to agree with that as well. And it sounds like that's exactly what you did. So did you release the book and have a book celebration?
No, I didn't.
What? That's the best part.
Much to my wife's chagrin, she wanted to do that. And I was like, nah, I don't want to do any of that. So no, I didn't. I did think about it, but I'm not that kind of guy, I guess. I'm not a big fan of parties, and I don't like being the center of attention, so I just
gotcha.
I forewent that whole thing. Maybe in the future, but for some reason with this one, I didn't seem like the thing to do.
A more quiet release. That's great. No, that's still great. You know, some books just, some books actually, especially poetry, I think too, you know, that they really kind of just, they catch fire by word of mouth and people start to read them and share them. And that's, you know, that's kind of one of the pleasures of poetry as well, is that we get to hear it from somebody and hopefully people will hear it on Words on a Wire also, and then be tempted to buy it, or at least go out and buy it actually. So
yeah,
that's
great. So.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I described your book in the introduction to our interview, but how would you yourself describe the poems gathered in this book for our listeners?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. It's three sections, well, four really, but three main sections. And the first one is kind of geographical, I'll say.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is more personal / genealogical, and the third main section is, I don't know how to describe it, they're the more idiosyncratic poems,
right?
And that kind of didn't really fit in the others in the other two sections, but still poems that I thought were strong enough to be in a book.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And then the fourth section is kind of, I don't know, like a historical, mythological, longer poem.
Right. That's one of the things that I really liked about your book is the just the four different sections distinctly, you know, about place, about people, and myth or historical even, pertaining more specifically to the region that you write about and that you come from. So before we move on and I ask you many more questions, why don't we start off by having you asking you to share a poem for our listeners?
Okay. So there's this poem in the first section. It's actually the last poem in the first section. It's titled Alakto Miko.
Okay.
And this poem is also somewhat mythological, and it's also kind of a tall tale, I'll say.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, just to give you a little background, it's about Billy Bowlegs, or Billy Bolek,
mm-hmm.
who was the last Seminole chief to resist the relocation to Oklahoma of the mm-hmm. Seminole Indians.
Wow.
He was chief during the Second Seminole War. And Alakto Miko means alligator chief. Mm-hmm. It's actually Holata Miko. But
mm-hmm.
When I wrote the poem, I accidentally put the title as Alakto Miko. But I liked it better that way, so I kept
it. Yeah, I agree.
Okay, so it's Alakto Miko. And it starts with an epigraph by a gal named Minnie Moore Wilson. The epigraph is, "With the desire to read and write, however, ended all ambition to be like the white man." Alakto Miko, Billy Bowlegs, last Seminole chief, was not as brave as Osceola, half-white saint, nor did he possess the gravitas of Micanopy, high chief on Cuscawilla, but was lazy and contented until dread gray cloud side-wheel steamer took him up the Mississippi in 1858. Edgemont Key, Endstop, Oklahoma. You could have seen it coming, Bolek, waking from one of your mid-afternoon naps, or while you sipped Aussie legs up after dinner under the shade of your ample chickie like king shit sultan. You should have known this life was too easy for an Indian, Alakto Miko, alligator chief, last king of the glades. I wish you could read this and give me some notes, but the dead don't read, and you never could. How long did March of 1858 ring in your ears like a cracked bell? And what is liberty if not the right to a little self-indulgence? Is there an empty slot machine at the reservation casino with my name on it? Can you spot me, Billy? I'm good for it, I swear. Three lemons in a row and I win one of your beautiful angry wives or your sullen, slow-eyed daughter. Olato Nico, big man, Kingfisher, where the hell are you? In New Orleans, goosing a Creole whore, dancing down Burgundy with a bottle under your arm? Where do dethroned Indian chiefs go when they die? Cleveland, Kansas City, Tallahassee? Is there a great spirit? Are you somewhere leaning on a sable palm, Billy, like an indolent day worker waiting to be bullied by Colonel Harney's men? It's the 21st century. You can come out now. No one plays cowboys and Indians anymore, and you can't sit Indian style. What did you do, Miko, proto-American, when your life was foreclosed on? And what's Muskogee for failure? Oklahoma? House poor, henpecked, drunk, and 30 pounds overweight, you walk out of your palm frond McMansion to the edge of Lost Man's River and let the familiar chatter of feeding gulls carry you across the water to the other side where the scenery is better and less demanding.
And if you're just tuning in, you are listening to the voice of poet Stephen Lambert, who just read from his latest book, Heat Seekers. Great poem there, Steve. Let me begin by asking you, how many years did it take you to accumulate all the poems that make up this collection, Heat Seekers?
Good question. The oldest poem in the collection is in the third section.
Mm-hmm.
Titled On Being Sick,
right,
page 79. And that poem is probably 15 years old.
Wow.
But the rest of the poems are under 10 years old.
And like during the process of accumulating these poems, at which point did you finally realize, you know what, I have enough here to kind of put a book together, You know, what was that process like for you in compiling all these into a book?
Really, I think that happened at UTEP when I was in the MFA program at UTEP, because I was accepted as a fiction student. And I just, the more I wrote and the longer I was in the program, the more I came to realize that it seemed like I should really start focusing on a poetry thesis instead of a fiction thesis. It just seemed like I was more prepared for that.
Right, right.
So just sort of during the 3 years I was in the program, I just sort of drifted that way and then started slowly putting them all together and then figuring out which one should go in each section. And so it was, I guess it was kind of an organic process.
Right, and this was if I'm not mistaken, this was a part of what you delivered as a thesis here for during your time at UTEP. Is that right?
Yeah. The manuscript was the thesis manuscript was about 50 pages long.
Right.
So it was about half the size.
Right. Half of that
of the finish of the book. Yeah.
As for the poems, I want to talk about a couple of specific ones. Your poems, you know, they include reflections on family poems that talk about, you know, your grandparents, even your parents. There's even a reflection on a, quote, a contentious family photo that's here.
Yeah.
How has your family received the book? Or, I mean, have they read it?
Yeah, so the book just came out last September.
Right.
So a lot of the people who might have something to say about certain poems in the book, I haven't really talked to yet, but yeah. I have emailed back and forth and message back and forth with some of them, and it's all been positive. So
good. Yeah,
we could continue in that direction.
You do like what I did with my dad. My first collection of poetry that came out in 2004, they were poems that were very personal about family and growing up. And my dad's a trucker, and I met him at a truck stop, and I handed him the book, and I said, okay, enjoy reading it. And he drove away, and I didn't have to talk with him for about a month. And then a month later, I asked him, did you like the book? What'd you think about it? I was actually really worried that my dad was going to just not like the poems or, I don't know, just, you know, have his own critique about what I wrote about. And all he said to me was, I'm just happy I'm in a book.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes.
Yeah, but you never know. It's true. You never know how people are going to react.
You don't, right? You don't, because you know, as writers, we feel the material is ours if we live the experience, and then, but you know, other families have been involved in many of these situations, or you know, as you put it, there's some contentious subjects sometimes, and it just makes for difficult conversations or things that people don't want to bring up, and you know, and here you are being a poet, you know.
Yeah, and I think you have to be careful in other an aesthetic sense, because some for other people, nothing is more boring than another person's genealogy. People can be really, you know, if you want to bore the hell out of someone, start talking about your family genealogy. So when you write a poem about your family, I think you have to be really careful and do your best to make it relatable,
right,
universal, whatever, because if you don't put some, you know, there's not some great imagery in there, and some,
right,
and if it's grounded in some sort of specific scenario,
right,
then you can really bore somebody to tears with something like that.
Right. And I think, I mean, you mentioned sort of this sense of the poem, trying to make the poem more meaningful on a larger scale than just for you and your family, like poem becoming, I guess, universal is another way of putting it, more universal. But, you know, one way that I found that, or I feel like your poems do that, is also using the idea of place, you know, and by talking about the people within a given place and by extension, talking about the place itself, you know, you really do make this, you do broaden that sort of lens for the reader. And I feel like a good portion of the poems actually include the region from around, I think it's Southern Illinois to down to Florida. So can you talk a little bit about how or why place really matters in your work?
That's a good question. So I do believe that when I first started writing poems, I never really thought about place that much. But really about 10 years ago, I discovered the poet Richard Hugo.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a little bit of an obsessive personality. And so when I get into something or like a writer, I get very into them. And I read everything I can. I buy everything. And I just sort of immerse myself in whatever world they created. And I did that with Richard Hugo. And I really loved the way he would start, you know, his poems aren't necessarily about a place, but he would start with a place,
right.
You know, as he talked about in Triggering Town, as a Triggering Town,
right.
he starts with a place and then he lets that sort of take him anywhere.
Right.
And he does, you know, he lets the poem take him anywhere. And
right.
he uses the place as a jumping off point. So that was a big influence. And then I've always found my family, specifically on my paternal side,
mm-hmm.
endlessly fascinating. My mother is adopted, so I don't know much about her side of the family.
Right.
But on my dad's side, and that has its own fascination.
Sure, yeah.
Even, you have a poem about that in this book. But my dad comes from a really, in my opinion, interesting family.
Right.
They've been in the South for seven generations. And,
wow.
You know, there's some Confederate soldiers in there.
Right, right.
It's also very rare to be someone who's from Florida. Florida is a place you move to.
Yeah, and, that's right.
You know, right. So, and I'm a third generation Floridian, and you know, so that's kind of interesting to me, and you know, and it's on its face. So,
mm-hmm.
just being from Florida and having my dad's family be from Florida and being in the South for such a long time, and growing up hearing all these stories about my dad's crazy family members, it's always been captivating to me.
Yeah.
Endlessly fascinating. So,
yeah.
It just seemed like a natural thing, I guess. Sorry, I'm kind of rambling.
No, go ahead.
It seemed like a natural thing when I really started, writing a lot to sort of focus on them.
Right.
And at first I tried not to, because I thought it would be kind of boring to
sure.
people who, outside of my family, but you know, I guess finally you have to just do what you can do.
Yeah.
And it became one of the prevalent themes in my writing, you know, family and place, and how place forms identity, and how family forms identity.
Yeah.
And things like that.
And there's a real sense of the historical, you know, woven throughout all of the poems. Like you yourself mentioned, you know, your family has a long legacy of being there in that particular region of the United States, and also has its own rich historical past.
Right.
And you bring all of that to light, very subtly at times, and other times it's at the forefront of the poems. You know, particularly one of the poems I really enjoyed reading was Little Egypt. It's one of my favorite poems in the whole collection.
Oh, thanks.
So, you know what, before I ask you how that poem came about, would you mind sharing it with our listeners?
Read it now?
Yeah, please.
Okay. Little Egypt for Glenn. Southern Illinois is Kentucky, resigned to the fact that it is not Kentucky. You take me to a town named after corn where there are no cornfields. Everything here seems like it had to be here. It was not enough for someplace else. The hills here are not majestic. Don't roll. They loiter and slouch like self-conscious teenagers. Something beautiful is always around the corner, but never materializes. A very old Indian sits on a bench in front of a store that sells knickknacks and trinkets, tourist crap. He is a trinket. We get tourists in Southern Illinois, you say, but not many. This town could be called Resignation, but it is not that self-aware. I ask him to take a picture with me. I like to help people, he says. His name is Mongo or something. He is Cherokee. I'm too old to be your souvenir, he says. All I have is this bench and a cave in the woods. He looks down, these shabby clothes. I'm sorry, I say. It happens to everyone, he says. I've killed rattlesnakes with my bare hands, killed a white man. You look at me and shake your head. The earth is Indian, he says. She will kill us all in due time. We don't go in. I feel both here and not here, like an idea thought better of. You are here in Little Egypt, my friend, because it is too hard for you to be anywhere else.
And if you're just tuning in, that is the voice of poet Steve Lambert, who just read from his latest book, or actually his debut collection of poetry titled Heat Seekers, and that's out with Cherry Grove Collections. So tell us about how that poem, Little Egypt, came about.
So it's for my friend Glenn, who lives in Southern Illinois. He and I somewhat grew up together in Central Florida, and we lived together when I first started going to college. We had a lot of fun together. And then for various reasons, he ended up moving to Southern Illinois, which is where his mother and stepfather lived. And he just felt, I guess, better there. He had a tendency to get in a little bit of trouble here and there. So I just felt like, and I went to visit him twice. And the second time I went to visit him, I just sort of felt like, you know, he was here because it was too hard for him to be anywhere else. That's where that sort of notion comes from. And when we were there, we met a guy named Mongo, who was Cherokee. And he was a pretty fascinating guy, and we had some beers with him at a bar. And some of the things that in the poem that I put in his mouth, he did say. Not all of them. Some of them I made up. That's where that one comes from.
Wow. And, you know, there are also some of my favorite poems are actually ekphrastic poems in the collection. And if any listeners aren't familiar with the ekphrastic, they're poems that are basically that they're based on photos or images. And you have a few of those in the collection. In fact, one of the actually the cover of the book, Heat Seekers, shows it's a great cover. It shows this tough looking brawny guy with a tank top on with his fist up. He's like a pugilist, like from back in the day. It's black and white photo, and he's looking, his hair's all slick, and he just looks like you wouldn't want to meet him anywhere, actually, in that stance.
Right, tough looking dude.
Yeah, exactly. And there is a poem actually that I do want you to read in a little bit, but tell me a little bit about why you know, gravitate towards writing ekphrastic poems based on, you know, on these photographs.
So I don't know why. I guess I can't tell you why, but in general, but specifically with the photo that's the cover of the book, it's my grandfather, of course. And I've grew up seeing that picture. There are very few pictures of him because, as the photo hints at, he was a bit of a rascal and he wasn't around a lot. And I just always found that photo very alluring and interesting. And, you know, I just remember being a little kid and pulling it out of my dad's desk drawer and looking at it. And, you know, it's just a really attention getting photograph. And, you know, a lot of these poems that are about family, you know, like I said, that I kind of call them family mythologies because like mythologies, they're part truth and they're part fiction. And so I felt like I could really play with that idea with this photo if I were to write a poem about it. So I just tried writing a poem about this photo, and it is part fiction and it is part truth. And, to be honest with you, I didn't think it was that great of a poem, but I went with it. I revised it a few times, sent it out. It did finally get published, and so I put it in the book.
Yeah, it's a great. It's one of my favorite poems. And I think the photograph is the poem that the photograph that the poem that is based on the photograph is titled "Pugilist at Best."
Right.
If I'm right, yeah, okay. And why don't you? We only have a few more minutes before we start to close out. So why don't you share that poem? Because I want to ask you a couple things before we close. So why don't you share that poem with our listeners?
Okay, and I'll skip the epigraph.
Okay.
Pugilist at best. Your arms up in a boxer's pose, hands, loose fists, a black and white photo circa 1940, but I can tell your eyes were pale blue, like no one who followed you. Granny's Northern Irish blood intervened, gave us all a dark Celtic complexion, smothered out the Anglo-Saxon blue. Genetics is like that, brutal, like your loose fists that tightened on impact. This picture doesn't say much. Poor white boy, mid-30s, handsome, arrogant, bad with money. How much did the photo booth charge? Who went hungry or without so that you could play at winning? Who taught you that pose, the total knockout?
And again, that is the voice of poet Steve Lambert, who is reading from his debut collection of poetry titled Heat Seekers, out with Cherry Grove Collections. Let me ask you here, we got a few more minutes left, Steve, and I want to ask you what made you want to pursue poetry. How did poetry find you?
I guess ever since I was about 12 or 13, I was always a kid sort of prone to creative or constructive endeavors. Mm-hmm. And I just, from that point, you know, I started drawing. I used to draw a lot, and
right.
I wasn't that great at drawing. And then I tried my hand at music. I wasn't great at that. So I just kept trying stuff.
Right,
until
right.
Something. And when I was about 21, 22, as I said, I tried writing. And it was the first thing I ever tried that seemed like I had some facility with.
Right.
Granted, I wouldn't say I had any talent or that I was any good at it, but it seemed like something I could do.
Right.
So I stuck with it. And,
nice.
Yeah, here I am.
And we're all grateful for that. Last question before I let you go. What are you working on next?
So I have a short fiction collection that I've been sending around.
Nice.
Yeah, so I've been sending that around. I think it's at about 6 different publishers right now. And I am almost done with the first draft of a novel.
Wow, that's fantastic.
But it, like I said, it's only first draft. So that's going to take some time. But, yeah, I keep writing. I keep writing poems, keep
Great.
Writing short stories.
Wonderful. Well, we look forward to everything that you put out there. You know, we're big fans of yours, obviously, here at UTEP. But I hope that all of our listeners get to pick up your book and check it out, Heat Seekers. And the poet is Steve Lambert. Thank you so much, Steve, for being on our show.
Thanks, Tim.
Absolutely. We wish you all the luck. We'd like to thank our guest today, the brilliant debut poet, Steve Lambert. Be sure to pick up his book titled Heat Seekers. You will not be disappointed. That wraps it up for this edition of Words on a Wire. I would like to thank our wonderful, magical producer, Lauren Terrazas. And I am Tim Hernandez. We'll see you next week, same time and place, here on KTEP 88.5 FM.